Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello. Today is Saturday, March 1st, 2014. This is Sword Brethren and Kaiser filling in for William Fink, who is on the road right now. Tonight's show will be on Hitler, the leading up of the prelude to the Second World War and the Second World War, titled Geopolitics, Hitler's Active Defense of Germany. Hello, Kaiser, are you there?
Yes, Brian. Nice to meet you again.
Good. Good to have you here. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks. Fine.
I believe you said that you first wanted to discuss the title for the show and the reasoning behind the title.
Right. I chose the term geopolitics because actually it's an historical term applied to Nazi doctrine holding that geographic, economic, and political needs of Germany justified its invasion and seizure of other lands. Now, that's just that's just your typical definition of it. But it's also it can apply to any sort of a combination of geographic, demographic, and economic decisions affecting a nation's foreign policy.
Absolutely.
Right, and also I call it an active defense. It's actually a military term. It means the employment of like limited offensive action or counterattacks to deny a contested area or position to the enemy. So, and I call it that specifically defense because all Hitler's decisions to invade another country were based on the defense of Germany, not because he wanted to take over these lands.
I certainly would agree.
Okay, I think we should start off. We have the first attempt at Hitler to assert German power on the continent within Germany itself was the Rhineland. And we should start off with that.
All right. Well, I'd like to ask a quick question, though. To what extent do you think Hitler's views were shaped by Karl Haushofer? I'm sure you're familiar with Haushofer.
You know what? The name doesn't ring a bell with me right now.
He was a geographer and a geopolitician, as well as being a German. I believe he rose to the rank of general at one point.
Oh.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, he was advocated that Germany should pursue a continental alliance with Russia, later the Soviet Union. I believe that was one of his major points.
There were some definitely benefits for Germany to make an alliance with Russia at that time, but how could that mesh with German National Socialist philosophy,
Right. So obviously, such a policy might have been possible with Russia, but it was not possible with the Soviet Union and may not even have been desirable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can't make peace with a gang of murderers.
Right. I think that we'll eventually get into that. I was going to say it was inevitable that Stalin would eventually betray the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. It might have been possible to come to an understanding with someone like Khrushchev, who, while a communist, was still not a Jew. He was still a white man, a white communist with some degree of honor. But Stalin, you can't bargain with the devil.
Well, I would agree with that.
All right, and you wanted to start with the Rhineland now.
Right. Germany, Hitler wanted to, just challenge the Versailles Treaty, the onerous Versailles Treaty. And the first attempt that he did that was it 1935, I believe, to send German troops, about three battalions of which to the Rhineland. And later he said that his decision, the next 2 days for him after making that decision, were the most nerve-wracking of his life because he didn't know how the French would respond.
Right, and the French had been there since they'd occupied the Saarland since after World War I, and the Rhineland was demilitarized. The Saarland was a small portion of the Rhineland, but not the complete Rhineland. The French were actually occupying the territory of the Saar Basin, and they were extracting all of the raw materials and mineral resources from that territory.
And right, they were trying to get reparations for the First World War.
Right, and they executed a number of German patriots in the Saarland, the Saar Basin.
Well, I'm sure there's some. There had to have been some atrocities going on.
Right, and it was 1935 that Germany reintegrated the Saarland into the German Reich, with the I believe the League of Nations actually approved that, and the Rhineland was remilitarized though. And I believe I want to say March of 36, German soldiers marched into the Rhineland.
Yeah, well, these troops that were sent in there, there was only about 30,000 of them, and they were given orders to be ready to leave at a moment's notice, because if the French had responded, there was nothing the Germans could do. They would have to go running out of there.
Well, I think at that point the French realized that there was no reason to stop German soldiers from operating on German soil, that it wasn't worth the war.
Right, exactly. Well, they were being more reasonable at that time.
Right. The only people who would have wanted a war over such a minor issue would have been Jews or munitions makers.
Well, yeah, we all know that.
I recall, too, along a similar corollary, in 1989 when they were opening the Berlin Wall, one of the Soviet commanders of a Soviet army unit in East Berlin, he was asked, you know, what to do. His men wanted, you know, one of his subordinates, I think a commissar, wanted him to instruct the unit to open fire on East German citizens that were now flowing across the now open border to the west. And he said, why should I start a war to prevent Germans from one side of this wall from going over there to visit with Germans on the other side of the wall? He said he wasn't going to start a war over that. And he told the commissar basically to stand down.
Yeah, there comes a point where the power of tyranny has to be disregarded.
But the remilitarization of the Rhineland should not be looked at through the lens that most Westerners are looking at it through, that it was step one on Hitler's plan for global or continental domination. He was simply reasserting German people's rights in their own land. The United States wouldn't take well to Mexico saying you can't bring soldiers into Texas, you have to keep them out of Texas. No sovereign power would allow an outside force to dictate terms under which they're to operate in their own land.
No, the French did not see 30,000 troops as being a big threat to them.
Certainly wasn't worth the war, and fortunately no war resulted.
Right, exactly. But Hitler was very nervous about it, and but 2 days went by, and the French did nothing, and then it's history. And you know, and this was a strategy of Hitler's. He would let things. He would take a step, and he would let nothing happened. He would be relieved, and then he would wait a while before even attempting to make the next step to let things calm down.
All right, so what more would you like to discuss about the Rhineland?
Well, I have nothing really more to discuss about. I think that's really all I've said about it can be said. As far as the Saar is concerned, I'm not sure if the French actually, did they actually leave that region, or did they leave it, just let the Germans come into it?
There was I believe it was a plebiscite, which was held with the approval of the League of Nations, and the population voted overwhelmingly for the Saar Basin, which was at the time a League of Nations mandate being administered by the French. They then rejoined Germany after the conclusion of the plebiscite. It was around 90 to 92% of people voting to rejoin Germany. Less than 10% voted against it, and most of those were committed leftists, or they weren't actually Germans. They might have been French or Jewish, or they had some personal or ethnic stake in staying out of a German state.
Right. Well, especially after the if they were Jews, the laws that the Germans enacted against the Jews.
Ian Kershaw quotes that, following the vote, Hitler announced that Germany had no further territorial demands to make of France, and we know that that is true because they never pushed the issue of Alsace-Lorraine.
No, Hitler did not want that back. Being forced to actually attack France later, then they probably did take it. I think they did take it during the war as reparations for them for having to fight that war. I mean, if the French did actually declare war against Germany, Germany didn't want war with France.
Right. In fact, if I recall, Germany made an offer of peace that they extended to the French and the British, for that matter, shortly after the campaign in Poland had been concluded.
Yes, they did. In fact, Hitler offered to withdraw German troops from the German-occupied region of Poland. Unfortunately, for the Poles, you know, they had to give up the Soviet-occupied area. But, you know, they said no. And, of course, you know, what do you do if somebody says no? You're at war and you're going to stay there.
Right, and that's another interesting point there I'd like to address, too. The Allies, you know, Britain and France, were supposedly bound by treaty, obligation, military alliance, and their sacred honor to defend Poland against German aggression. Yet Poland was not merely invaded by Germany, but by the Soviet Union as well, and no one seemed to even utter a word in protest, let alone declare war on the Soviet Union.
Well, it was bandied about by some, but of course, you know, that wasn't going to happen because Soviet Union was looked on eventually as by Churchill as a potential ally.
Right. And I think they were anticipating needing the Soviet Union to basically destroy the Axis powers and usher in an era of communist tyranny across Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe.
Yeah, which actually turned out to happen. But actually, moving on, I mean, with the German reoccupation of the Rhineland, you know, now you get the first part of the Treaty of Versailles being nullified. And so challenging that treaty, you know, which was, you know, actually was just completely unfair to begin with. Hitler was asserting his power and also gaining confidence to take his next step, which was, you know, he had declared right from the beginning, it was no real secret, that all Germans should be reunited with Germany.
Well, think about Wilson's 14 points. He talked about self-determination and ethnic self-determination, and right at the end of World War One, the first thing they declare is that Austria cannot unite with Germany. I believe that was in the Treaty of Saint-Germain.
That's right. That's correct. That was in fact in 1919 they made that treaty, and it was it was just wrong. That reveals the real reason behind the Treaty of Versailles, and that was to deny. It wasn't to allow people the freedom of choice of where they wanted to live and what country they wanted to be part of. It was actually to deny Germany any power whatsoever.
Right, and you know, the Czechs and the Slovaks did not want to live in a country with each other. The Serbs, Croats, Bosnians, Slovenes, they didn't want to live in one unified artificial Yugoslavia. They weren't consulted about that. They were just told, okay, here are the new borders, here's the new nation, you're all Yugoslavs now, go live together.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know why they, I mean, we all know what happened when Tito finally got in there. He, he ruled with an iron hand, and when he died, the whole thing fell apart anyway.
Right. The main purpose I see behind these treaties of Saint-Germain, Versailles, it's to deny Germans their right to self-determination and to keep
right.
Germany divided and weak.
It divided and weak is more like it. I mean, they really didn't care about German self-determination. Maybe some for other peoples. And then you can see that being, that being given to other peoples, especially when they asserted themselves enough to be able to gain it, like in the case of the Sudeten Germans.
Right. Well, they were too numerous to be kept down. There were, I think, 3 or 4 million of them.
There's about 3,200,000, somewhere around that there. Anyway, I'd like to go through this chronologically, if we could. Austria would be the next step. The Austrians were Germans. They spoke German. When the Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up, they got this little portion of landlocked area, which, contained ethnic Germans, but they were not allowed to reunite with Germany. And as it turned out, they wanted to be reunited with Germany.
Right.
There was, actually there was some oppression for the National Socialists in that region. But
under the so-called Austro-Fascists.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure exactly what they call themselves. I know there was the Christian Socialists. There were certain party leaders, especially the leader of this fellow Shushig, I think it's called.
There was the Fatherland Front under Dolphus.
Right. He actually turned out to, I think he was assassinated by National Socialists for his repressive measures.
Right, and then Kurt Schuschnigg came in after him.
Schuschnigg, right. And he also exacted the repressive measures, and Hitler demanded that he not jail, he released from prison National Socialists who were just trying to, were forming their right to have a party.
Right.
I mean, go ahead.
At the time, the Austrian system that they were using for their the basis for their party, the Christian Social Party and the Fatherland Front, it was a form of Italian fascism, Austrian's own unique political Catholicism, and it was at least ambivalent and neutral on the issue of Jews, and in some instances they embraced the Jews to the extent that I believe Jews were allowed to have membership in the Austrian party at the time.
Well, they were members, more of majority members of the the Social Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And they were based mostly in Vienna, where most of the Jews lived. Of course, they opposed reuniting with Germany because they know what that would mean for them. That means they would either have to leave or have to get out of their lucrative businesses that they had at German's expense, by the way.
Right, but the incorporation of Austria into the greater German Reich. Today, the Austrians try and portray themselves as the first victims. They say that they were annexed by the evil Nazi regime, and that's just historical revisionism on their part because they don't want to admit that their grandparents and great-grandparents were thrilled, ecstatic, and clamoring over the prospect.
Yeah, well, they can't say that with any reasonable credibility when somebody knows the facts and presents them with these photos of the cheering crowds with Hitler in an open-top vehicle riding through the towns, and especially to his hometown and then to Vienna, we were just greeted by 200,000 people in the Hero Square.
Right, and no one's trying to harm him, and you don't see tanks in the street keeping people in line. There are no goons holding up signs that insisting people applaud and throw flowers or else. Those are genuinely happy people.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And not only that, I mean, when they actually did do a plebiscite to a vote for Anschluss, for the reunification, it turned out to be like 99% in favor. So how can you say that's not a can you imagine an American election with you had 99% of the vote?
Right, and even if there was some inflation, if only 10% of people approve something, but you report 99%, word of mouth is going to reveal that that's a lie. People are going to start talking with their friends, and when they see that, hey, you didn't vote for that, I didn't vote for that, we don't know anyone who voted for that. How did that get 99%? So it was either 99% or pretty darn close.
Yeah, well, that's the numbers I was given.
Right, but I'm just saying that you cannot perpetrate a fraud on such a colossal level, where if some Democratic politician, let's say in 2012, Obama had won re-election with 98.9% of the vote or 97% of the vote, I don't think anybody would accept that it's not plausible.
Right. And, people who say that Austria was annexed, I've heard that term bandied about, in regards to Austria, and that's just absolutely untrue.
No, in the Western countries, the Western democracies, they have election fraud down to an art. It's always, 51-49, 50.5, 49.5, 52-48, very close, and it's plausible. They know better than to try a Mugabe style, 98-99%. The fact that this plebiscite in Austria had close to 99%, it must have been genuine. If it were false, there would have been an uproar. The people that, didn't vote would have been protesting.
Oh, absolutely. There were no protests. In fact, I will mention, though, that they did exact a little vengeance on the Jews there in Vienna. Because the Jews painted the sidewalks and building and walls with slogans about against reunification. And the German and the Austrians populace, you know, they forced Jews wherever they found them to scrub them off the walls and sidewalks. And they took some pleasure in doing that too, I'll definitely admit that.
All right, so
well,
we're both in agreement that the German movement into Austria, it was not an invasion. And to demonstrate that, the Austrian military crossed the frontier into Germany at the same time. German soldiers marched into Austria, and then Austrians marched into Germany, and then marched back into Austria alongside the Germans.
Yeah, I haven't read that anywhere, but if you have, then yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
And I find it particularly odd that today, well, not odd, I understand why, I find it distressing and depressing that Austrians don't refer to themselves as Germans anymore. They call themselves Austrians, but Austria is just a government political entity. It's
right.
Not an ethnic racial identity. They're just Germans living in another nation.
Well, I mean, you can call them Austrians. I mean, as a Swabian, we'll call himself a Swabian, a Bavarian, and a Saxon, or a Prussian, or a Hanoverian. You know, I mean, they all had their own little enclaves within Germany itself. I mean, but in reality, they're all Germans. All right, maybe we should move on to Czechoslovakia.
All right.
All right, back in 1938, when they were having this Czech crisis, I mean, the Sudeten Germans actually owned, had a very prosperous area within the Sudetenland, and being forced to be incorporated as part of this multi-ethnic state called Czechoslovakia, an artificial entity, as we all know, was actually oppressive to them, because now the Czechs had control. They had political power over these ethnic Germans, and they exercised that political power against them by taking their land, giving it to Czechs, and just forcing the Germans to pay a large amount of taxes, because they were the richest demographic within the country. And therefore, and because of their hard work and, you know, their diligence, and therefore they had to pay pay for this redistribution of their wealth towards non-ethnic Germans. And of course, the Germans, they never, no matter what the Czechs did, they could not force these Germans, either force them or coerce them into accepting to become part of their demographic. The Germans did not want to be a part of it. They wanted to be in Germany.
Right, and of course, the Jews didn't want to allow that.
Yes, well, you know,
I think the main purpose behind the creation of Czechoslovakia was to allow for the existence in Central Europe of a state that would basically cause contention, confrontation, chaos, confusion, and if at all possible, serve as a launching platform, a springboard for an ultimate inevitable Red Army invasion of Central and Western Europe. Czechoslovakia is basically a thorn in the side of Central and Western Europe, but I'm not saying that to malign the Czechs or the Slovaks. I'm saying that the creation of such an artificial state, it was not on good intentions, is basically what I'm getting at. The reason for the creation of that state was to serve as a focal point for a future war.
That's very possible. I mean, I don't know what the reasons were for combining the Czechs and the Slovaks.
And the same thing with the basis for Poland's borders. The creation of Poland in the aftermath of World War I, I think that was done with the intention that hopefully it would lead to another world war.
Well, you see, that's let me get to that topic when we reach it, Poland after the Czech situation. But the because the Germans were being oppressed in this region, Hitler felt that it was his solemn duty to protect these Germans. So again, his active defense would be to say demand that these Germans be incorporated into Germany. And eventually there were clashes between the Czechoslovakian army and the German citizens within these areas and the police.
Right. Well, the Germans were treated basically like scum, if I'm not mistaken. In Czechoslovakia, they were assaulted, beaten. Hitler said that just because they wanted to practice German culture, they were being beaten bloody.
There was one protest that a mass of Germans did, a peaceful protest, and they were just, they were just beaten up by the Czechoslovakian army. Until they went back to work, you know, they didn't protest again until later on when tensions did arise again for being, for having these oppressive measures instigated against them. One was, you know, it was either social and economic, forcing, Czech schools within German region, vast majority of where just Germans lived, they didn't want to learn Czech language. They wanted to be German.
Right, and that's not unreasonable, is it, that Germans want to learn German?
Exactly. But I think what really rose tensions was the fact that the Czechs were being... were actually stealing from the Germans. Stealing is a harsh term, but, you know, to having your land confiscated and given to a Czech, what would you call it?
Right, well, there's no two ways about it. It's a form of theft.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, this all came to a head, and then eventually the British and French, the British liaison who went there to speak with the speak with the Germans in the Sudetenland, he found that they should be reunited. You know, that there's nothing they wanted was anything unreasonable. But unfortunately, the Czech government, you know, I mean, when you form a state, you know, the state entity sees itself as being under attack when people want to leave it. And, of course, this is the case, because they knew exactly what would it would mean if the German part of Czechoslovakia were to leave. Then the Hungarians would want to leave. The Slovaks would want to leave.
Right, and there were Ukrainians in eastern Czechoslovakia. They would want to leave as well.
I don't know how many Ukrainians there were. It was rather a small number, I'm sure. But but there were some Poles, and the Poles... And in the end, you know, instead of, you know... we have the Churchill and the War Party, and his Jewish backers wanted to screaming for war, and you know, lambasting Chamberlain for making peace in our time over the Sudetenland. And this, what he, everyone conveniently ignores, that the treaty also allowed Poland to occupy the Polish areas of Czechoslovakia and Hungary to do the Hungarian areas that was also majority Hungarian population.
Right. Well, it's rather convenient to forget all that today, so no one really wants to talk about it.
Well, yeah, it is old news. Let's face it, we're talking old news here.
I mean, we're on the same page with this, but some people may not know it, and historians don't want to bring it up.
Oh, yeah, I got some criticism about the one particular historian that I'll mention later. Go ahead.
It doesn't fit the paradigm. You know, the paradigm,
right.
Hitler well, bad, everyone else good. It's the ultimate fight between absolute good and absolute evil. That's the paradigm, the narrative.
Yeah. I was going to mention that, too, that the paradigm, which is an excellent word. I actually used that when I was discussing the situation with my discovery of the Jewish conspiracy with some friends of mine who were, you know, hostile to me. They were... I was saying, I just don't buy the paradigm anymore. I don't believe it. And once you discover these truths, you realize that, hey, wait a minute, this is what I've been told all my life is a lie.
Well, most people don't want to admit that it was possible that they were fooled for, you know, not just months and years, but possibly decades, because it reflects on them. Or they would feel it reflects on them. So they'd rather continue supporting and defending something that is wrong than coming out and admitting that they were fooled for 30 years.
Yeah, well, I can't blame somebody for believing something that somebody they trust or enough people that they trust tell them, or what the society itself tells them. However, I do blame them for not questioning, you know, their this paradigm and why, and what we know as fact is that there is a Jewish conspiracy, and they should investigate it. I think it's part of being a person of God, you know, I mean, if you want to call it that, is to search for truth.
Right. Well, you know, some people, it seems, don't hunger for the truth. They're content to basically stay mired in falsehoods, distortions, half-truths, and outright lies.
Yeah, which I find it quite amazing, where somebody is that dull-witted not to want to discover these things.
You know, maybe they have the spirit of deep sleep. You know, they have eyes that see not and ears that hear not.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting psychological analysis that we can do up on people, but, you know, everyone is different in their own belief system, you know.
Well, you know, one thing people often wonder, too, is why the German people supported Hitler, and they think he was some occultist who made a pact with the devil, and the devil gave him the power to seduce the masses with articulate, brilliant speeches and his wonderful, spectacular oratory. And, of course, he was a great speaker, but I don't think even a great speaker can come into a country where people don't like the ideas you're saying, they don't want to hear it, they're not interested, and then get them to do a complete 180. People supported Hitler because he painted a vision that they could all rally behind, a vision of a unified, strong Germany where the rights and the liberties of the German people were respected and where Germany wasn't being bled dry with reparations payments to foreign countries that just wanted to loot and pillage.
Right, and it took at least 10 to 12 years to build that type of movement.
Right, and people that, you know, the older generations in Germany, anybody who was born in, say, 1933, 34, 35, 36, up until about 45, they should be thanking Hitler for their existence, because otherwise they probably wouldn't have existed at all. They would never have been born if Hitler did not stabilize the country and bring about the conditions possible for a revitalization in Germany.
I mean, you can, but what the Allies did to it later was, you know, certainly not a blessing. No.
Right. Well, you know, in 1932, I believe there were 70 million people in Germany, and about 200,000 suicides that year, I believe.
200,000? Wow.
There were a large number of suicides in Germany leading up to Hitler's rise to power.
You know, and I think that can be definitely directly attributed to the Jewish control of the Weimar Republic.
Right, and in 1932, there were only 23,000 suicides in the United States. Well, I don't mean to say only. I'm just saying that by comparison, the United States had twice the population of Germany and only about 10% of the suicides.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you look at the year Hitler came to power, the suicide rate plummeted, and it continued going down after that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that reminds me also about the Austrian situation. When Austria was not united with Germany, they had, you know, they were just as bad off as the Weimar Republic. They had, like, a 26% unemployment rate, or something phenomenal like that. And, you know, when you're unemployed and you're a man, especially in the 1930s, you know, when there was still honor left in men, or at least some honor, you know, in where work was considered your, you know, your definition of a man. I mean, that destroyed your psyche, and your hopelessness would just overwhelm you, and then I can understand why people commit suicide.
Right, and I think those unemployment numbers, I think they're substantially understated.
It's possible.
They're artificially kept low. Unemployment, they say, let's see, in Britain, unemployment was around 70%. I believe in Germany it was at least 50%. And in America, we could only begin to guess. You know, they say, oh, 25%, the worst it's ever been. But, you know, they manipulate those numbers.
Well, yeah, you can never believe the government's statement of unemployment, because they always want to make it sound like it's not as bad as it seems for the most of the country, you know.
But what can't be manipulated, we see footage in Germany, newsreel footage, documentary footage from 1929, 1930, 31, 32, with the streets packed with the homeless, people living in shanty towns or in alleys, and masses of unemployed people in Germany fighting in the streets. We don't see that after Hitler comes to power, because those conditions no longer existed.
Right. The Germans were coerced in a way, or maybe not coerced, were encouraged and coerced, a combination of the two, to help one another.
Hmm.
Lift your brother up. That's part of the National Socialist philosophy. And it's also Christian, by the way.
Where in America, the Depression really didn't end until after World War II.
From what I'm told, yeah, because, you know, I mean, you took all the unemployed, you throw them in the army, then how many unemployed do you have?
Right, so you put 20 million people in the army and declare unemployment's over, but if you look at American GDP and economic activity, the war actually was a huge hit against the American economy, because we went basically up to our eyeballs in hock, financing a war that did nothing for us. We produced tens upon tens of billions in equipment that was either given away or destroyed in the fighting, and we didn't really do anything to invest in our infrastructure. So the war didn't really do a whole lot, but the removal of 20 million men from the rolls of the unemployed and allowing them to earn military pay, which they saved up, and then they suddenly came home and they all wanted houses and cars, the construction boom and the automobile demand boom, that finally ended the Depression. But the war itself, I believe, deepened and prolonged the Depression in terms of GDP.
Yeah, that's possible. That's very possible. The banks, you know, they had no money for employing people before the war, and then all of a sudden they had all this money available for the government to finance a war. You know, so obviously the banks wanted this bad period to happen so that they can force the government to go to war with Germany and Japan, mostly Germany, actually.
Right. I'd say, but you know, by the very definition, a war cannot end a depression, because you're taking productive items from the society and you're basically throwing them away. They're being destroyed on a battlefield. And Hitler understood that. He said that he does not make war for material gains. He does not want to make war. He does not want wars to continue or to be prolonged, because it robs him of his ability to focus on rebuilding the German nation and helping the German people, because war is destructive and it doesn't do anything to help build up the nation or the people.
No, it doesn't at all. It's he said something to the effect that, you know, every day that this war goes on, it robs me of the time or the ability I need to help the German people.
But it seems in this country they see wars as a way to boost the economy.
If you're not really building anything or helping people, I mean, how is that boosting the economy other than the fact that you're giving people, you're sending men off to war, assuming whether you have conscription or not, the army is going to need men, and they're going to advertise that they need more men, and people think, okay, maybe I could save up some money for college by going into the army, even though we are at war. But it removes people from the workforce. And it actually makes you just another government parasite in the end. Because what are you doing other than enforcing Jewish foreign policy?
Right. In fact, I believe I was in the speech on the 8th of November, 1940. Hitler declared, "I extended my hand, often in vain. They wanted this fight. Now they shall have it. The German Volk will see this fight through to the end. The danger that it might erupt again within 1 or 2 or 3 years after a period of heightened tensions must be removed. The German Volk wants to have peace finally. It wants a peace that allows it to work and which does not allow international scoundrels to agitate among other peoples against us. These
right.
are the folks who make their fortunes through war. I have no reason to wage war for material considerations. For us, it is but a sad enterprise. It robs us, the German Volk, and the whole community of so much time and manpower. I do not possess any stocks in the armament industry. I do not earn anything in this war.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler did a complete... You can't... The one thing, you can't accuse Hitler of being a greedy man. I mean, he did everything and nothing... They can't take this away from him, no matter how hard they try, is that he loved his country. And he loved his people, and the people loved him, and that's all there is to it. And he didn't do it out of greed.
Right, well, you notice Hitler riding around very slowly in an open-top car with minimal protection, where American presidents and British prime ministers, they don't go anywhere without basically a battalion or at least a company of bodyguards, uniformed, plain clothes, armored vehicles, drones overhead, helicopters on standby.
Well, I mean, assuming they play the game, I don't know who they think they should be afraid of.
Right.
But if they're, you know, it's maybe all this, that's just for show, or maybe they think they do need that type of protection. But in reality, I just don't see who would hate them enough. I mean, there must be some. But the only people who really get assassinated as politicians are the good guys, as far as I know. I mean, there are some exceptions, of course. I mean, you're like this Dolphus character that we mentioned earlier.
Right. But those are rare exceptions.
Yeah, there are rare exceptions. I mean, sometimes, I mean, you really have to make somebody very angry to want them to actually kill you. You know, other than, you know, I mean, to the Jew, it's, is he in my way? Oh, okay, we've got to get rid of him, one way or another. And that's all there is, it is to them.
All right, now, after Austria... And after the Sudetenland, around the same time, I believe that they regained the Memel territory, Memoland. I believe the Rump state, the remainder of Czechoslovakia, collapsed. The Slovaks gained an independent protectorate type state under the Catholic priest, I believe Tiso, and the remainder of the Czech state was annexed by the Germans.
Well, I wouldn't call it annexed. It was actually Hitler did, you know, he invited the chancellor of that of Prague of that of the region of the Czechs to come and see him, and he basically browbeat him into accepting a protectorate so that he could secure German position against the communists and the Jews that were in Prague. So against taking over that little area and using it as a base of operations against Germany. I mean, he did it, this fellow, I'm sorry, his name escapes me, but he went to see Hitler with his daughter, and they greeted him nicely, but Hitler did spend the night with him, maybe browbeat was a...
Are you talking about Emil Hatcha?
Let me see. I think that was his name, yeah.
The Czechoslovak president.
Yes. Yes, that was him. And he eventually signed the terms, and the German army just walked in there and without any resistance.
Right, so if it was an invasion, why didn't the Czechoslovakian army mobilize and oppose it?
Yeah, that's what I don't understand is why there wasn't any real opposition to that, even in spite of what the president signed this agreement with Hitler.
Right, and I would say I would call it an annexation, but I would not call it an invasion. And the Czechs may not have been thrilled with the prospect of annexation, but obviously they weren't opposed, or at least they weren't opposed to the extent that they were ready to take up arms and fight a war over it.
No, there was no resistance I mean, that which seems odd. I mean, after the tensions between the Sudeten Germans and the Czechs there. But apparently they accepted the status quo, and they said that what the Germans wanted was not too unreasonable. And maybe they'll benefit from being a protector of Germany.
I don't believe during the German move into Czechoslovakia, I don't believe a single person died in any sort of hostile action.
Right. The German army just, like I said, they just walked in.
Right, I mean, maybe there was a car accident or two, or a truck maybe went off the road, or a horse might have fallen over and crushed somebody, but there were no bombs being set off, no hit-and-run attacks, no resistance or guerrilla activity, and certainly no conventional military resistance.
Well, I mean, if you were Czech, I mean, and you realize, maybe you, I'm not going to claim to know what's going on in their head, but maybe what the Germans and Hitler were saying were right about these Jews. Maybe we should accept them in here, and they'll take care of business.
Right. Obviously, they weren't happy with the conditions under their present state, under their present system. They wanted something different.
Right, and that's probably had a lot to do with why there was no resistance. So you can't say that the Germans invaded the territory. They did. I mean, Hitler insisted upon it, and when he finally got Hoxha to agree with him, he was elated. He said at that moment he brought two of his secretaries. He talked to them and he said, "I've just made myself the greatest German ever." You know. So that was definitely a win for him because he secured again that southern flank of Germany against any communist infiltration or anything. All right, moving on to Poland.
Poland is a lot more problematic. I think mm-hmm. the Poles actually wanted a war. They were spoiling for a fight.
Yes, they were. Yeah. I mean, Wrigley, what was his name?
Yeah, that guy with the hyphenated name that none of us can pronounce.
Well, Smith, let me
Smith
do
Wrigley.
Yeah, that's him. He said, you know, back in 1930, he said, and even before Hitler even came on the scene, he said, you know, Poland wants war with Germany, and there's nothing the Germans can do about it. But basically, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said.
Right, he said Germany will not be able to avoid war with Poland, even if it wishes to avoid it.
Right. I mean, when you have people like that, and there were, and I'm sure there were many others that we thought like him. I mean, especially him being a general and a leader of the country. There must have been many Poles that thought that way. And the reason why they thought that way is because they Poles, as usual, they were agitating with their neighbors one after another. The Ukrainians, I know they were agitating with them. They took Ukrainian lands and they oppressed the Ukrainian people in the lands that they occupied, as well as the Lithuanians. They caused a war over that because they wanted some of their land. They caused I think even there was a minor conflict over with Czechoslovakia at one point. And of course the Germans had their troubles with them too.
And if I'm not mistaken, Poland managed to get itself into a war with the Soviet Union in 1921-22, sometime around then.
Right, I think 1920. And they managed to fight them back, but they probably wanted to take advantage of the fact that the communists of the, revolution in Russia, so they can steal some more land.
Right, so
and
post-World War One Poland, if you look at it, they fought wars or skirmishes, confrontations with every single one of their neighbors.
Yeah, the Poles, you know, I don't know what's with them. I think it's, you know, throughout their history, I'm not sure what brought about their annexation by Russia, Austrian Empire, and Prussia. Maybe they thought that, hey, Poland, let's just not this thing down. and they just conspired with each other? Or was it because they were tired of Polish, aggression? I don't know what the reason was, but the Poles were very aggressive in the early part of the 20th century, and they just overt about it. I mean, to attack the Soviet Union? I mean, come on. I mean, it didn't seem like a great thing. It wasn't a great power back then, but the Soviets did drive them back, and all the way back to Warsaw, but they made a successful defense and drove the Soviets back, and they were probably lucky in doing so. And, of course, all during this period, they had skirmishes with Germans on the border.
You're referring to the skirmishes in what, Upper and Lower Silesia and along the western border?
Right, exactly. And there was in the Lower Silesia, I think they were, they actually performed a couple of, at least one workers, I would call it protest, where they took over the government there and then they became part of Poland.
And if I'm not mistaken, on one of their invasions or major incursion into Germany, they were only driven back because of the rapid mobilization of the Freikorps.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. I remember reading about that. It was the Freikorps that defended Germany against everything that
right.
the Jews could throw at.
And that, of course, was a main motivation for the ceiling of 100,000 men being placed on the Germans in regards to the upper limit of their armed forces, because a nation as large as Germany cannot be effectively defended by a mere 100,000 men when surrounded, you know, France, Poland, Czechoslovakia, nations that have large populations and large militaries.
Well, no, they couldn't possibly defend themselves.
Right.
They would be hard pressed to police the nation.
They would have been at the complete mercy of the Poles.
Right, and when you have an ineffective government like in the Weimar Republic, how much are you going to assert yourself with that 100,000 men? I mean, assuming you even have, like, say, a fifth of them, with the we're ready to call upon them to defend the country. You know? Anyway, the land that was given to Poland, particularly the corridor area, I mean, there are, it's a mix of population there. Some have a majority Poles, some have a majority Germans. But there were a lot of Germans, there was no question that there were a lot of Germans in the area that was given to Poland. And, they were still a minority, but still a very sizable one. And the port city of Danzig, which the Poles used for trade or needed for, shipping, for imports and all that and exports, it became a free city, but it was nominally under the control of the Poles, and even though it was 96% German.
Well, the Germans made a very reasonable offer to the Poles. And the primary feature, in my opinion anyway, of this proposal was an alliance with Poland, and they agreed to defend Poland against any external aggression, which, without coming right out and saying it, of course, that means the Soviet Union, and the Poles would have known that and understood that. And I would think an agreement to have Germany defend Poland should be worth more than an agreement from Britain and France, because Britain and France, even if they intend to follow through on the agreement, geographically speaking, they're not in any position to defend Poland and honor the agreement.
Right, exactly. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to mention the 4 points that of the the treaty that Hitler wanted to offer Poland. In fact, let me start with the first part here. It's the first part is first the return of the Free City of Danzig to the Reich, but without severance of its economic ties to the Polish state. So the Poles wouldn't lose anything economically by having Danzig become part of the Reich. This offer would guarantee Poland free port privileges in the city of Danzig, as well as an extra territorial access to the harbor. Again, so they wouldn't lose anything. Two, the second point, Germany would make no demand for the return of its former territory, now called the Polish Corridor. But Germany should be allowed to build a highway and a railroad across the Polish Corridor in order to reunite Germany with East Prussia, so they can have pass goods back and forth and help the people in East Prussia, you know, from the main part of Germany. I mean, I don't see that as unreasonable to allow trade to go through that, especially when you're considering splitting it. I mean, they gained from this by having Germany being split in two. And, you know, so this is reasonable. Number three, mutual recognition of the location of the borders between Germany and Poland would be permanently settled. In other words, Germany would not demand return of any remaining territory ceded to Poland by the Versailles Treaty. So you're not demanding any land from Poland. I remember those propaganda terms that the Jews want, that we were, you know, fed about Germany and Poland. I just want a peace. I want a piece of Poland, which is a lie. I mean, this is clear right here. Okay, and number four, the German-Polish Pact of 1934 would be extended from 10 to 25 years. Okay, in this pact, the both countries, you know, pledged to resolve their problems through bilateral negotiations and to forego armed conflict for a period of 10 years. The pact effectively normalized relations between Poland and Germany, which were previously strained by border disputes arising from the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, so this way they would settle the border dispute problem at the same time. And Germany would not demand any acquisition of Polish territory. So how can... this is the propaganda that we're fed about Germany attacking Poland, when in reality the Poles did not agree to this, and I will get to why they didn't agree with it, these very reasonable terms, in just a moment, as soon as we... let's get to it now. The British started... the faction of the British that wanted war, we all know who they are.
Oh, yeah.
They told the Poles, don't agree with anything, Germany, we'll back you up. And the French told them that too. And Roosevelt even got involved and told Poland that. So what purpose would, let's say, a man like Roosevelt, what interest does America have in for Germany and Poland to settle their differences peacefully by telling them not to agree to any Hitler's terms.
Right, so basically America is saying don't allow peace to prevail. They're bringing about a situation, a set of circumstances where war will become inevitable.
Right. And the Poles, you know, and you know what? And this played right up into the people who wanted a greater Poland. They talk about a greater Germany. But let's talk about a greater Poland, because that's what the Poles really wanted. They wanted all German land up to the Oder, and they eventually got that after the war. So who really wanted lands that didn't belong to them for themselves? Of course, it was the Poles. So
you would agree, though, that Poland was on the verge of coming to an agreement with Germany, and the Americans torpedoed it.
Well, I would say not just the Americans, but the British and the French.
Right.
I mean, they decided to draw that line there rather than settle things permanently between the Poles and the Germans, where there would be no more border skirmishes with the Poles. There would be the Poles would agree to this border here and allow Germans free access back and forth from east to and from East Prussia. But of course, they really didn't want that. Even though it was very reasonable, based upon their hatred for the Germans, they hated a lot of their neighbors. And you know what? Unfortunately, you know, the Poles. You know, I don't want to mention. I'm mentioning this only because it's a fact that the Poles have become the brunt of jokes. For a long part of their history, at least, you know, I mean, so when I was growing up, you know, it was a joke to be called a Pole, you know. And I it's not something that I like hearing, because they are one of our people, you know. It's just that and you know, their actions throughout the, especially the early part of the 20th century, were just ridiculous. You know, it's like they are completely unreasonable. They want to take other people's land for themselves, and when they, the Germans did eventually, you know, go into Poland, you know, they issued you know, orders for atrocities against German civilians. I mean, some of these, I mean, you can see some photos of these people, but I mean, we're talking, I don't want to get too graphic here, but they were just horrible ways they were treated. I mean, and then they're murdered.
Well, we can't hear about that because a particular group of people has a monopoly on all human suffering. So we can only hear about how the Germans threw babies in the air and caught them on bayonets. And
yeah, that's been widely acknowledged now as being just British propaganda. I mean, the German propaganda was nowhere near as intense as that. I mean, they basically ridiculed their enemies, but they didn't portray them as being brutes. And when the Poles, they enacted their revenge against German civilians, and that showed a bad nature. I don't ever remember hearing of any German atrocities against Poles. You know, I mean, you may be able to point out some instances, let's say the Warsaw Uprising later on in the war.
Right, but that's not really a German atrocity against Poles. That's crushing a insurrection movement comprised mostly of communists and Jews.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You can call it that too. But for all those years that the Germans occupied the region, the country, I mean, do you ever once hear of any real atrocities against Poles?
No.
No, I've never read one. I mean, I haven't yet come across one. Maybe I'm not reading the right stuff, but I've never read it.
Well, if the Germans were half as bad as we've been told, then there shouldn't be anybody left in countries like Poland. They should have all died.
Yeah, basically, yeah. This is funny. I mean, it's like they want to fall. They want to say that the Germans, you know, were these, you know, this master race stuff, and that never, those words never came out of Hitler's mouth. I don't think I've ever heard him say that or even read it in Mein Kampf. But the way people don't want to acknowledge that there were Slavs who, you know, they always claimed that Hitler absolutely hated, and all the Germans hated them, and all that. And in fact, you know, Slovaks were Slavs. You know, I mean, you don't hear any atrocities against the Slovaks because they were allies of the Germans. Oh, the Bulgarians, and then of course the Ukrainians. I mean, and many of these people contributed to the German army. In fact, at Stalingrad, one in four, up to 25% of the German infantry strength was made up of ethnic Russians.
Right. Several million Russians and Ukrainians served in some capacity, either in the Waffen-SS or in the Heer, you know, the regular army, or they served as auxiliary helpers.
Yeah, excuse me. They formed their own divisions, and they were given their own uniforms with their own designation. They were known to be Russian. Later in the war, when the ROA, the Russian Liberation Army and the Russian Liberation People's Army were fighting, against partisan activity. Most of these were Jewish partisan activity, by the way. And and being a partisan means you have to necessarily, you can't take prisoners. So you're basically an illegal combatant. you know, you're going to kill any prisoners as it may take. I mean, so it would be suicide for you to surrender yourself to a partisan, or at least almost certain suicide.
Right, so if the Germans were out to exterminate all the Slavs, as conventional wisdom tells us and mainstream historians won't shut up about, then why would so many millions of Slavs rush to fight in the German military?
That's the question. The fact is, the Germans did not treat them any worse than anyone else. I mean, when they fought alongside with the Germans at Stalingrad, for instance, they were treated just like Germans.
Right. I was going to say there was a Croatian unit, at least I think a battalion or a regiment that fought at Stalingrad.
Okay, yeah, there was one too. The Croatians were definitely German allies during the war, and the Ostasi, who controlled much of western and northern part of the former Yugoslavia. They policed the region, but they did it in a very brutal fashion.
It was called the Croatian Legion, the 369th Reinforced Infantry Regiment. It fought at Stalingrad and was pretty much destroyed there.
No, along with everyone else. But moving on, this was the situation. Getting back to the situation with Poland, when Hitler finally made the decision to go into Poland, it was only because every diplomatic effort was exhausted. The Poles would not give an inch. And I'm not sure how much atrocities they were committing against the Germans in that era before the war broke out, but it doesn't really matter at this point because they were still having border skirmishes with the Germans, and this was not going to be settled with anything short of war at this point. So the Poles got what they wanted. They wanted the war with Germany. They got it, and they lost.
Right, well, like I said, they were spoiling for a fight, and they bit off more than they could chew. So they thought they could just trounce Germany in a real easy campaign, since the Germans had been systematically disarmed and their industry had been dismantled in the 20s, and it didn't occur to them that Hitler could have rebuilt Germany so rapidly in just 6 years.
Well, not only that, the Polish, they were also a veteran army, having fought the Soviet Union. Their tanks were were a match for whatever the Germans had. But their generalship was lacking, their leadership was lacking, and they lost very quickly to the Blitzkrieg.
Right. And if I'm not mistaken, that guy, Rid Smigley, the name that we can't pronounce, he fled his headquarters and basically left his men to their own, their fate, basically, and the Polish army essentially collapsed, and remnants of it fell back into Romania.
Yeah, that I did hear of, but I did hear that he fled. And so that's part of geopolitics, that the Germans, in order to defend Germany, they had to have war with Poland, because the Polish were intransigent. They refused to recognize the rights of Germans and the need for Germany to help their own people over in East Prussia. Okay, moving on. After that, of course, we know what happened. The British and French declared war on Germany, and now Hitler, who did not want this war, was thrust into a European conflict now with his Western neighbors, whom he never wanted to go to war with.
Well, it's easy to blame Germany, but even now, Russian politicians are openly discussing how Poland started the war, or at least served as a catalyst for the outbreak of war, and that the Western powers in Poland are to blame for taking a situation where compromise was easily achievable and forcing a war.
Could you expand upon that, please?
I'll have to find the name of the Russian. He's a senator in the Duma. I forget his name, but it was within the last several years he was condemned by the typical crowd, you know, the Jews and other people.
Well, I mean, getting to the point where once war started between Britain and France and between Germany and the Western major powers, Germany showed that they didn't really want to initiate any fight with them by, you know, not doing anything offensive in the West.
Right. Here,
you know,
years ago, the Russian Defense Ministry posted an inflammatory essay, according to the Telegraph.co.uk, claiming that Poland resisted Germany's ultimatums in 1939 only because it wanted to obtain the status of a great power, and it had been backed up by assurances made by Western politicians. The Defense Ministry official Kavoliov called the demands quite reasonable. He said the overwhelming majority of residents of Danzig, cut off from Germany by the Treaty of Versailles, were Germans who sincerely wished for reunification with their historical homeland. Everyone who has studied the history of World War II without bias knows that the war began because of Poland's refusal to satisfy Germany's claims, which he added were very reasonable. The paper was titled Fictions and Falsifications in Evaluating the Soviet Union's Role on the Eve of World War II.
Yeah, well, I mean, that sounds accurate to me.
And the British referred to it as a lengthy diatribe, which is unlikely to be welcomed in Warsaw. That's very objective reporting, isn't it? And this comes from Adrian Blumfeld in St. Petersburg.
Well, I don't know if he's Jewish or not, but it sounds like he is. But who goaded the Poles into maintaining that position, that
right.
intransigent position? And
Jews
it's,
and Western allies.
Right, exactly. You won't, I doubt you'll have him say that, though. I mean, let's move on to the phony war. Now, this demonstrates that Germany had no designs on the West or, you know, invading all of Europe, of course, again. It's like, is by maintaining a defensive posture on the Western Front, where nobody was attacking each other. And, you know, this was getting to the point, we all know our old friend Churchill, he was in the pay of the Jews, and he wanted to have a war with Germany. He wanted to have offensive capability against offensive action against Germany. Now, in order to provoke that, you would have to bomb Germany, because the Germans were not going to attack in the West. They just weren't. I mean, it took so the first thing he wanted to do was try to starve Germany out, and so he would try to take their ability to wage war against them, which was, of course, their supply of iron ore from Norway.
Right, and it's interesting that the Germans supposedly, if you want to call it that, invaded Norway, but they arrived just as the British were arriving to begin mining the harbors and the ports of the Norwegian cities along the coast, which would have been a violation of Norway's neutrality, a violation of Norway's sovereignty, and a violation of international law. So it was to Germany's good fortune that they arrived when they did. I don't think they picked that day by coincidence. I believe they had discerned the British intentions from a network of spies and their intelligence operatives, and they knew they had to act now or the British were going to shut down their iron ore supplies from Norway, and the British were even thinking about invading Norway and then Sweden as well.
See, I don't know about I didn't hear about the Swedish part. I mean, do you think the British Army was capable of doing that?
They were certainly going to try. At the very least, they wanted to launch some commando raids into Sweden to destroy the rail infrastructure that was leading to the coastal cities along the Baltic.
Okay,
that,
well, that sounds like it's within their capabilities. But, so Hitler, I mean, let me just give a little bit. This is something that I read from the U.S. Army War College, an historian from there. Hitler was of two minds about invading Norway. He didn't want to do it, you know. But what were those iron ore deposits? If those iron ore deposits were threatened by the British, he had to do it in order to protect. Because it was the only supply of iron ore from Germany ever had. Without it, you can't build tanks, you can't build planes, you can't defend, you can't build locomotives. Anything that needed steel or metal, you can't build now. And Churchill, of course, knew this, and that was his little operation he wanted to perform, was an invasion of Norway and take away those iron ore deposits. So at that point, Hitler felt, okay, he made the decision, we don't have a choice. And it took the entire German surface fleet in order to pull off this operation, and they lost 10 destroyers, all 10 of the destroyers sent on the Narvik operation.
You're referring to when they came across those British battleships and they were just cut to pieces?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were. I think there were two cruisers involved. I mean, the German destroyers, they wouldn't have stand a chance against them. But they lost 10 of them, eventually lost 10. And the Germans there up in Narvik were cut off. And, in fact, they were considering surrendering to the British that were there. Because the British did land in Norway. They did. So the Germans got there just in time for this operation. And they were surrounded by the British. I think it was the entire regiment. But they managed to hold them off. And eventually the British left sometime in June of 1940. But, for the Germans, in order to go get to Norway, you need to go through Denmark because you needed the air bases there in order to land your power troops or having air cover.
Well, also,
and
if you don't control Denmark, you can't shut down access to the Baltic. The British would have sailed right into the Baltic.
Right, the Skagerrak. That would have been it was a necessary operation. The Germans, again, you know, it's okay, what do we do? Do we allow ourselves to be starved from our ability to defend ourselves, or do we invade Norway and secure our iron ore deposits? And so they had to do it. They felt they had to do it. And the German invasion of, let's say, Denmark or something, was not oppressive. You know, I think they allowed all these civil administrations for their own people in there. As long as they did not interfere with the German war effort, I think they left them alone.
Right. Well, the Germans didn't just wake up and decide to invade Denmark for the hell of it. They didn't want to bring war to Denmark.
No. In fact, there wasn't a shot fired. There was I should say, that's not exactly true. The Danes did fire a formal shot just to show that they, you know, they waged war against Germany for invading their country.
Well,
but it was just a ceremonial thing.
About 300 people died, though, on both sides.
Oh, yeah, there was some resistance then.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't read that. I heard that the Danes just, you know, allow the Germans to come in, you know, I mean, with some, just a formal declaration, show of resistance, but it wasn't really actual.
A large number of Danes did join various German SS units.
No, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, Leon de Grel, we all know about him. He was a fanatical part of the Waffen-SS.
He was from Belgium, though.
Right. And, you know, that gets into the next part. I mean, okay, so, you know, everything Hitler's decision was in order to maintain the German position of defense of Germany, not to wage war, but to defend them against attack from the Western Allies. They had to have these iron ore deposits. There's just no, you couldn't defend yourself without. All right, moving on. The eventual outbreak of war in the West, in France and the Low Countries. This occurred, I believe, only happened on May 10th when the Germans made the decision to attack. May 10th, 1940. And that was the very same day that Winston Churchill or Chamberlain was ousted as Prime Minister in favor of Winston Churchill, who favored the bombing of Germany. And he started bombing Germany on May 11th. And the Germans did not have long-range bombers that could reach Britain. They only had two-engine tactical bombers that were made for war. So it's either you allow yourself to get bombed, or you attack. Only means you have available, which is your army. And so they made the decision at that point that, okay, it's time to go in and to deal with this once and for all. Because Hitler understood before the war that if Churchill, a man like Churchill, were able to become prime minister, he would not be able to make peace with this man. He understood that.
Churchill was a madman.
that's some people think so, yeah. Me, I think he was just, Churchill was all out for Churchill, and he was a megalomaniac in his own way.
Churchill thought of himself as some brilliant genius, but look at Britain before Churchill and after Churchill. In the immediate aftermath of the war, the British began to lose their empire. Within 3 years of the end of World War II, they lost India, which was the jewel of their empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he allowed the British Empire to be, be sucked dry by this war, which really had no benefit for Britain at all. But it did benefit Churchill personally. He received huge sums of money from through that focus group back in the late 1930s that he became part of, and it was from Jewish contributors that would funded his campaign to get control, get the prime minister, get to be the leader of Britain. Now, of course, he was beholden to them, so he had to do it. In fact, there were times when he was considering the German peace terms, but then later on he would say, "What am I crazy? I mean, if I accept the German peace terms, then I lose everything." His mountain of debt would would be consumed in mountain of debt. He would probably be ousted as prime minister. So he had nothing to gain by accepting German peace terms. So he's the one that caused that war and allowed it to continue unnecessarily for as long as it did.
Well, they worked so hard to bring about a war, they couldn't lose it now. They didn't need peace.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so funny, I mean, that the average Brit allowed themselves to get suckered into this once again, and the French, they didn't show a whole lot of enthusiasm for the war, I guess. Some of them did, but, the French succumbed, just like the Poles did. The Blitzkrieg just, annihilated them. But the Germans did not have an easy time, attacking France. There were times when it was scary that they could actually lose by British counterattacks. Now, if the British and the French were able to organize themselves enough, they could have launched some serious attacks against the Germans. But as it turned out, the Germans won, and they had to occupy France. I mean, the British would not make peace. The French, let's say they told the French, okay, we defeated you. We're not at war anymore. We're going to leave now. And while they're still at war with England, or Britain. And so would that change the situation? I mean, for Germany, no. The German city would still be bombed by British long-range bombers. So the Germans
right.
had to occupy France, and so if they can maintain their close air bases, so they can retaliate.
And the French, I think, would have re-entered the war against Germany.
It's possible. That's quite possible. So they couldn't take that chance, you know. So, I mean, and the Germans really didn't begin retaliating against the British until, like, weeks later for bombing civilian targets. And I'm sure Hitler didn't want to do that.
It was actually months later.
It might have been. In fact, there was one part where I saw a video on David Irving. He was delivering his what he found out about Winston Churchill. You know, one day one of his staff saw him looking at the sky with his fist out up. It says, "Why won't you come?" And he's talking about Hitler, you know, about bombing London. So, I mean, the invasion of Britain, this Operation Sea Lion, was not Hitler's project. He did not want to do it, and he showed a very lack of concern for it. He wanted to go east, though, because there was evidence that the Soviet Union was about to attack sometime in 1941. Which is another interesting thing. I mean, people seem to discount this, that the Soviet Union was a real big threat. I mean, because of their poor showing in war against the Finns and was it a year earlier. But they were very much a real threat. And I mean, to get in all to the details of the reason why the Soviets were going to attack Germany. I mean, we covered that with Bill on another show. I think you and Bill covered it. Viktor Suvorov, a man who writes under that pen name, covered the topic that Stalin was gearing up for war and he wanted to attack Germany.
Right. No question about it. Absolutely.
Right. And numbers of aerodromes and air bases being built upon the border of Germany, which only meant that you're about to do offensive air campaign against your neighbor.
Not to mention those Red Army units. Few of them had maps that detailed their immediate locations, but a lot of them had maps that covered Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, the German-controlled part of Poland, Germany itself. They had maps for invasion, not for defense, and they were deployed very far forward in their immediate jumping off points and staging areas. They weren't deployed, you know, for defense in depth. They weren't prepared to receive an attack. They were prepared to initiate an attack. That's why when the Germans attacked, they enjoyed some spectacular success in the first 6 months.
Well, that's very possible. I mean, if you had a defense in depth, yeah, like the Germans faced at Kursk a couple of years later, the Germans would have been bogged down, and if they were prepared in defensive positions that was you know well thought out, then the Germans could not possibly have had such an easy time as they did. I mean, they reached Minsk in a double envelopment with two Panzer groups.
Right.
After the first week, you know. but before that campaign, we have to deal with Yugoslavia and Greece. Okay, you know, Italy entered the war under Mussolini, just as France was surrendering. So he wanted part of the glory for himself. And his occupation of Albania, he decided to attack for purely arrogant reasons alone, Greece, which Hitler told him don't do. And, he got in spite of massive number of reinforcements he sent to Albania, the Greeks were just, you know, beating the Italians. So Italy was at war with Greece now, and Germany and Italy made itself an ally of Germany.
Well, not only was Italy at war with Greece, but the Greeks struck back, pushed them all the way out of Greece, and took part of Albania.
Right, they did, in spite of the massive reinforcements that he sent there. And so, I mean, it stabilized at that point, I'm sure. But but during that time, there was a military coup in Yugoslavia, and was backed by the British. So, and before that, there was a the Germans had made an agreement with the Yugoslavian government called the Tripartite Pact, I think it was, and it would basically favor Germany in a conflict, so that they would not have to fear Yugoslavia would go over to the British side. Now, unfortunately, after declaring that, the king of Yugoslavia was deposed, and he fled the country to Kenya. I think he was interned there by the British. And by a military coup, backed by the British, too. And they took over the government there, but they said that they would uphold the terms of the Tripartite Pact with Germany. And Hitler didn't believe them. And rightfully so, he shouldn't, because they were backed by the British. So you have a military coup on your southern border, just about when you are ready to launch the biggest operation, which would you know, in the history of mankind, practically, against the Soviet Union, you know, a month later. You had to do something about this situation, because that means he didn't know whether Yugoslavia was going to go over to the British, but if a military coup backed by the British was any indication, then eventually they would go over to the British. Not only that, the British were also starting to commit forces into Greece. So they were on the mainland. And so the Greeks also, they would then use those forces in Greece to eventually move on into Yugoslavia once they convinced the Yugoslavs to fight on their side. And that was a chance that Hitler couldn't take. It was like your whole southern flank is then exposed. So they made the decision to go into Yugoslavia. And the Yugoslavian army pretty much collapsed very, you know, almost immediately. I mean, the Croats within Croatian units, they gave up.
A lot of them defected, basically. They quit
right
as soon as the invasion was underway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Germans formed the independent state of Croatia in there, and it was a large region consisted of like Bosnia as well as much of the northern part. But they also formed the occupational territory in mostly Serbia and Montenegro, where the Germans occupied, and they could never really police the entire area effectively, of course. But in fact, the largest partisan activity in all of Europe was in Yugoslavia. So the Germans realized they couldn't even control their allies, the Ustasi, initiating atrocities against their enemies. And this Balkan area, these people are at each other's throats for centuries, and there's nothing you can do to stop it, you know, other than police the area with a large amount of troops.
Well, the Germans can't be held responsible for the actions of the Ustasha, can they?
No. They did make some protests. Against them. For you're going to drive all these people to go into the partisans. I mean, don't do this. You know, and I'm not sure how much the Ustasha listened to them, but apparently it wasn't enough. But anyway, that's why they had to go into Yugoslavia and Greece. Unfortunately, Greece was only to bail out Mussolini. I mean, that was the only reason why they went there. And it's not something the Germans wanted to do, but they felt they had to. Because the British were also in Greece, and they had to throw them out too. And, you know, and then of course, Italy, you know, if you know the war situation, Italy was a drain upon German resources. It was not a help at all.
Well, the Italians weren't prepared for the war, and they were under-equipped. But in a number of instances, they fought very well. The units that were tasked with defending the flanks of the German 6th Army in Stalingrad, most of them fought until they were overrun and destroyed. And since they lacked substantial anti-tank weaponry, there wasn't a whole lot they could do, but they did fight on until basically they were completely destroyed.
No, I know that the Italians had some elite units, and they did fight well, especially, let's say, for instance, their best unit was the Ariete Division, which fought well at Burrell Gubbio in North Africa, and it did fight against the Germans eventually in Rome.
One of the major problems, Italian hand grenades rarely detonated. That was one of the main issues they had. A lot of their equipment was poorly made. It was left over from World War One. So really the fault would not be the Italian soldier then, but rather the men who sent them into combat ill-prepared and under-equipped.
Well, that was Rommel's, his belief about the Italian soldier.
If they had German equipment, they probably would have done a lot better. You know,
mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I really blame Mussolini for. He was in power from 22 onward. I believe it was 24, 25 when he consolidated and became basically an unquestioned autocrat. He didn't really adequately prepare for war, and it seems like he was intending on invading Albania and Greece, so he had at least 15 years to prepare, and he didn't really do a whole lot.
No. Well, I mean, okay, well, moving on.
Right, but you have to consider if Hitler had 15 years to prepare for World War II, Germany might very well have won.
Yeah, that's a long period of time for him. But, that the Yugoslavian-Greek operation was only to secure the German southern flank against a British invasion from the Balkans. And it was not because they wanted to take over Europe again, you know, or just asserting that, look, we have to defend ourselves. If we can't do this without securing these regions against the Soviet attack, nor can. And so, and if most of our army is going to be, you know, engaged with the Soviet army, then our flank is just exposed. So that was the only reason why they went to Yugoslavia and Greece. Okay, after that, now the Soviet Union. As it was said earlier, the Soviet Union were preparing to attack Germany. So the German and Hitler just beat him to the punch. Unlike most people, most of our own race, I should say, Hitler understood the Jewish question and what they were doing. Therefore, he took decisive action. He was one of our own that would take decisive action, and therefore to defend the white race and the European man against the Jews. And that's what, I believe that's what his invasion of the Soviet Union was about, was defending Europe against the communism, against Jews, because they understood what the communists were. They were mass murderers, and they needed to be taken out.
Right, and we're coming up on about 5-10 minutes remaining. Do you think we can discuss this in the remaining time, or do you want to come back later for a part two?
Well, I don't think there's enough for a part two, so I'll get to it quickly, because I just mentioned what the Soviet Union was, because the last one I wanted to discuss was the United States, and this is very important. Let me just go on this. There was, when Germany was winning, at this point in the war in December of 1941, Germany was winning the war, at least it looked like it was, but it was becoming winter. The Operation Typhoon was highly successful, the first part of the operation was, but the second part of the operation was to try to take Moscow, which they went, and it utterly failed to do that. The Soviets counterattacked on December 5th, when the Germans ceased their offensive operations. This counterattack involved the troops, the Siberian troops that they brought over from defending Far East against the possible Japanese attack. When they attacked, the Germans were not capable of holding their position, and they had to retreat. In fact, some of them retreated up to 200 miles. That's how bad it was. And even though Hitler did order a no retreat, still they couldn't hold their positions in the current locations. They had to withdraw. At this point, the Germans were very worried that the Soviets, they were not going to win this war. And with the with the Japanese attack on the on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, that meant that the Germans had to make a decision. Because the United States was already at war with de facto at war with Germany because of their lend-lease supplies to Britain.
And the naval war, too, the quasi-naval
yes.
war, the attacks on German U-boats and merchant ships.
That's right. They were escorting British convoys and with orders to attack the German U-boats for preventing war material from reaching Britain.
And, you know, Roosevelt even dispatched the old World War I battleship USS Texas, and he ordered it to engage and sink the Bismarck if the Bismarck was sighted by the Texas. And I'm certain he had to understand that a 30-year-old World War I era American battleship would not do a whole lot against the Bismarck. It could damage it, but it probably wasn't going to sink it. Maybe he was hoping that both ships would be sunk. You know, the Texas deals fatal damage to the Bismarck, but then is lost with all hands, and there's nobody to dispute his version of events that they were patrolling on a neutrality patrol when the Bismarck struck first. And I'm sure that's the story they were ready to run with.
Well, I know the Texas was based off of in that area, but I didn't know that he actually issued these orders. I mean, I never heard of that.
Yes, he said that if the Texas happened to sight the Bismarck or come across any other German warship, that it was to engage the ship and sink it.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, they ordered their destroyers to do that, right?
Absolutely, and I don't have much doubt that if the Texas had come across Bismarck and had initiated combat against Bismarck, it would not have ended well for Texas, but the Bismarck could have sustained serious damage, and depending if, you know, any lucky shots were scored, it could have been sunk. But the Texas would have been in, you know, mortal peril.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, this gets to the point that the United States was already de facto at war with Germany, only it wasn't, I should say, a known shooting war. It was actually a shooting war in some instances, but it was not known to the American public. But this is what an historian, which I have to criticize, his name is Michael Gannon. He made this quote about Hitler made his decision on December 11th, 1941, unilaterally, gratuitously, with no sound reason, declared war against the United States. That was a quote from him. And I thought that was...
He's not a real historian, then, or his objectivity doesn't exist.
Right. Exactly. Because we all know why. This is my contention here, is that Germany would... Hitler would, and the German high command would never have declared war against the United States if it were just for these incidents in the Atlantic. He would not have done it. If it wasn't, now that the fact that the Japanese were involved, he had to make a decision. Do we go to war with the United States also and prevent the lend-lease supplies from the Pacific, which accounted for 50% of all lend-lease supplies through Soviet ships, which the Japanese were ignoring? Should we go ahead and try to induce the Japanese to attack the Soviet Union also? Because if we help the Japanese out by declaring war in the United States, maybe they will help us out by declaring war against the Soviet Union, who is our real enemy. And if the Japanese had the foresight and the desire to do so, then they would have easily halted all Soviet shipping in the Pacific. And not only that, they could have, and their army might have been able to cut the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Right. I don't doubt that the Imperial Japanese Navy certainly had within it was within its capabilities to shut down the Pacific route of the American lend-lease to the Soviet Union. Easily attainable.
Right. Do you know how much that would immensely help the German war effort in the East? So to the point, I believe that they would have won.
Well, look at what extent the British and the Soviets went to keep open the supply route. They invaded the neutral country of Persia, and they divided it between themselves. The British took some, the Soviets took the rest.
Mm. Yeah, they had to maintain that lend-lease route.
I recall, when did they invade Persia? Was it late 41 or early mid 42? But the invasion didn't last all that long. It was over pretty quickly.
All right. No. They're basically just occupying the area. But this showed that there was a sound reason why Hitler declared war against the United States. It had to be a combination of those two reasons, though. If the United States was not doing anything offensive against Germany by supplying their enemies and attacking their U-boats, then they would never have declared war. But it took the Soviet-Russian counterattack to convince them that this was in their best interest, and they took a risk, and it just didn't pay off for them. The Japanese did not attack the Soviet Union.
Well, Germany did not want a war with the United States, but the United States made peace impossible.
Right, exactly. And again, this is about active defense of Germany. They declared war as a defense for Germany to prevent the United States from helping their enemies, the Soviet Union. I mean, this, and we're fed one lie after another about what the reasons why Hitler did this, why he did that. Well, Brian, I'm just about finished with my presentation about this.
Well, I hope we've cleared up some misconceptions. I think these points had to be established.
Yes, they did, and to know why Hitler made these decisions and that they were absolutely logical from beginning to end.
Right, so Hitler wasn't just some bumbling amateur. There was a logical reason behind every one of his decisions.
Mm-hmm. It was all about the defense of Germany, not about attacking other nations.
Absolutely. So you don't believe at this point that we will need a part two? We've set out to achieve what we wanted to achieve with just this one program.
Well, actually, as you, I didn't think we'd have enough material for this show, but apparently we did.
All right. Well, I believe Bill will be returning next weekend, and I'm not sure what program he will have for the people here. But thank you for coming tonight.
Oh, thanks, Glenn. I enjoyed it. Thank you.